So today, Luke chapter 12, we're going to start at verse 4. And this is kind of a continuation of the topic of last week, which was the idea of hypocrisy, where we say one thing with our words and we do another thing with our actions. And we know that that's a very common thing in humanity in general. And unfortunately, in religious communities, it's just as common. Our appearance as devout religious people does not necessarily mean that we have a transformed heart. And that's a tragedy because it's fooling both the person who's the hypocrite and also those who are around them, usually. And this is something, as we look at this today, we'll see this is something that God will punish for eternity. The most terrifying verse in the New Testament, in my opinion, Matthew 7:22, it reminds us of that. Y'all remember it says, "We did all these things in your name," and Jesus will say, "Away from me, I never knew you." There's some side of us that should be critical of ourselves, like mindful of our actions, to be aware of our motivations, to be inspecting the things that we do and the reason behind what we do them, and asking the question, is this for the praise of men, or is this for the glory of God? And that question, I think, will help us as we work through this topic this week, the fear of God's punishment, something to be mindful of, that He will pour out His wrath. It's going to be terrifying. We will be judged by the all-knowing God. And that should help this idea of the fear of men flee from us and be replaced by the healthy fear of a God who is all-powerful. So Luke chapter 12, I'm going to read verses 4 through 7. The parallel to this is in Matthew chapter 10. It's verses 27 through 33, and I'll make reference to those as we go through. But if you want to look at both of those places, Matthew chapter 10 and Luke chapter 12. So Luke 12, beginning at 4, it says, "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have nothing more that they can do. But I warn you, whom to fear. Fear him who after he is killed has the authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." Verse 6, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? And not one of them is forgotten before God. Why? Even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, you are more valuable than many sparrows." Those first two verses we're going to take as one chunk, and then the next two after that. So 4 and 5. "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who can kill the body, and after that have nothing more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has the authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." Matthew 10, verse 28, it says, "Do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell." Jesus opens that part with the address to those people that he's talking to, his friends. "I tell you, my friends." The word there that's used for friends is philos. It means friend, but deeper, much deeper than an acquaintance, much deeper than just someone that we kind of know. This is a brotherly love. Philos is the friend, is the noun of that, the beloved, sometimes it's called. Phileo is the verb form of that, and it means to act in that way, to act in a kind of brotherly loveness. If you've ever heard that Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love, it comes from that same root Greek word. This word about that kind of love, the love for one another. Like, we know that there are levels of friendships, like levels of relationships. There are close friends that we would count as close as a brother, or maybe closer than that, like a genetic relationship, sometimes stronger even than that. And then there are friends that are just kind of friends in passing. They're acquaintances. There's something wired into us as humans to seek to have those kind of deeper bonds. It's put into us to have this need of connection with other humans, to not live isolated entirely. I think part of what messes that up for us is that people are broken. So when we open ourselves up to those kind of relationships with other people and we get hurt by that, we don't want to do that anymore because we don't want to experience the pain that it can bring. It's not how it's supposed to work. There's several things that are broken about this concept, I think, in our culture, probably in humanity forever. In the Greek, there's four different groups of love. I know we've hit on these before. The highest of these is agape. It's unconditional. It's selfless. It's the type of love that God shows for us, regardless of who we are or where we've been or what we've done. It's a deliberate choice to show love to someone else without any strings attached. Very hard to do. There's eros. That's a romantic love, a passionate love, a sexual love. It's from the root word that we get the word erotic. Eros. That's a different kind of love. Then the one we're looking at here in Jesus' words is phileos or phileia. It's that loyalty, that camaraderie, that love of a friend. Then there's storge. And that's the bond of parents and children. That's a natural affection. It's the bond of family that's comfortable and enduring. But it's different from being unconditional. And that's where we get mixed up on these kind of things in English, is that we have one word that describes all of that and we abuse it. We love tacos and we love football and we love our spouse and we love whatever. And those are all very different types of things. It cheapens it. And I think that's one of the words for us to try to reclaim. Love. In this sense, it's a brotherly love, a friendship that's deeper than an acquaintance. It's one that would cause us to sacrifice for our brother, for our beloved. In John chapter 15, Jesus uses the same word. He says, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. That's a pretty good definition, I think, of a friend. They say, yeah, well, that guy'd give you the shirt off his back. And that's pretty good, right? But to lay down one's life for another is a big deal. Through thick and thin, when the sun is shining or when the sky is falling apart, when it's good and when it's really, really bad, that's the hard friend to find, is the one who's still there. That's right. That's the bestest one. And that's describing the bond that Jesus had with his disciples, that type of connection. And we can see that certainly all the way through of how he lived and how he died. That's a good friend. He says we're blessed to call him that kind of friend. He says, do not fear those who can kill the body. I think being killed or dying is probably one of the greatest fears that we have as people, right? That this life ends. And part of that's probably because we're going to miss all of these things. Part of that's fear of the unknown, I'm sure. Fear of dying may be just second to fear of public speaking. I'm not sure. That one's pretty high on the list of people will tell you they would rather die than stand in front of a crowd of people and talk. I don't know. But just think about our economy even and the amount of resources that we spend to try to prevent or slow down the inevitable. We're all going to die. one day, like this is it, you know, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe, but we're all going to die. And there's an immense amount of energy and resources and things that are poured into extending life just a little bit longer, to stay here just a little bit longer. And I've heard Casey say this a number of times, and it's true. Like, maybe it's time to just enjoy what we have left. Maybe longer isn't always the better. That's hard. That's probably true. But death, the loss, the separation, we've all been on the other side of that, where we have felt what it's like when someone is gone. And it still pains us, right? You can think of those thoughts right now and you would tear up. That's very real. That separation. Do not fear those who kill the body. Who kill the body. That's just one death. The death of the flesh. Honestly, as believers, that's the death to rejoice over. And this is terribly hard to think about, I'm sure, but that's the death of freedom. When this body is no more, when we leave the fallen world and we find our eternal home with God. See, death is not the same for everyone. He says those who can kill the body are of limited power. They can end this life, but that's it. That's all. And all of our medical technology and doctors and everything else, we can extend this life a little bit, but that's all. That's it. Do not fear those with such limited power. They have no bearing on the life to come. One of the things I read on this, and I'll read it to you, it's a little bit longer of a piece, but right on the mark, it says, the one with the authority to cast into hell is not, as some imagine, Satan. Satan is neither the one who sends people to hell, nor is he the ruler of hell. He says, on the contrary, he himself will in a sure future day be cast into hell, where he, Satan, will be its most notorious prisoner for all eternity. Nowhere in Scripture is there a command to fear Satan. Believers have been completely delivered from him in the present, because greater is he who is in them than he who is in the world. He says in the future he will have no influence on us, because the God of peace will quickly crush Satan under our feet. So instead of fearing Satan, he says, believers are to resist him, be weary of his schemes, and avoid giving him an opportunity to lure them into sin. He says, God is the one to be feared. Which is counter to so much of what our world tells us, right? To fear the demons and the devil and whatever else. The one to fear is the Lord, the one who has complete authority over this life and the next. Not Satan, not demons, not even the powers of this world. We fear the Lord, the one who can change all of it. Jesus says in our text today that after that, they have nothing more that they can do. After they end this life, that's it. Their power is done. For all eternity, there is no more power over us. He says, but I will warn you whom to fear. The one with that power who can kill this body, who can end this life and condemn the next for eternity. That's the one to fear, the God of now and forever. He says, fear him who after he has killed has the authority to cast into hell. Who can end this life on the earth and has the absolute power to condemn the next life forever. The word hell that's used here is a different word. It's Gehenna. Sometimes we see the word hell in the text. It refers to Hades, which is like the place of eternal punishment, or the destination, if you will, of hell. Gehenna refers more to like the burning trash heaps of eternity. It specifically makes reference to this valley of Hinnom. It's like the dump next to Jerusalem. It's where they would go throw their trash. And they burned it there because that's the best thing to do with trash, is to burn it instead of burying it. I mean, obviously. So they burned their trash there next to Jerusalem. And it was a constant fire all the time. There was a fire burning out there. But not only that, it was also a place where the pagans would worship. Even the Jews at times had been known to go out there and worship the god Molech. So in this fiery burning pit of the dump grounds, they would also go out there and they would sacrifice their babies, kill their children as offerings to this pagan god Molech, and leave them there. That's what it's referring to. And that gives us this picture of a place of eternal torment and punishment and torture. There's nothing good going on. Fear him. The book of Daniel, I think, gives us one of the better pictures of this idea in the scriptures. This is Daniel chapter 3. It starts at verse 16. I'll read to verse 25. If you want to think about the idea of fearing the Lord and not fearing man, this is it. Daniel chapter 3, verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression on his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated seven times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men who were bound with their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Verse 22, because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. Verse 25, he answered and said, but I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. It's a wild story. A few weeks ago, Fabian hit on this idea of Christophanies, the idea of physical manifestations of Jesus showing up in the Old Testament before he's born that first Christmas, before we know him as the infant Jesus born to Mary, the physical presence of God showing up as a man, as the form of a man in the Old Testament. This passage shows one of those appearances. Jesus didn't start at Christmas. We know that. He is, he was, he always has been, the great I am. He's transcendent of time and space. He's above all creation. He's knowing of all things, and he's powerful over everything, even life and death. In this scene of Daniel, we see a trust for God that exceeds the fear of man. Some areas of our country are absolutely corrupt. We know that. But in this time, in King Nebuchadnezzar, he had all power. All the power a human could exert, he had it. He could do anything. So when he orders these people to worship his statue, he has the power to do anything he wants if they don't listen. And he decides he's going to kill them. And he can kill them, or he can order them to be killed, and there are no repercussions. There's no punishment. There's no nothing. He orders them to be killed, and he sits back down and finishes breakfast. They knew that. It's not a secret to these three guys. But they didn't fear anything the king could do to them because they knew the all-powerful God. If there is one to fear, it's the one who is all-powerful. Because even if the king were to kill them, if they were to be thrown into that fiery furnace and burned up to nothingness, it would not affect their eternity at all. So something to keep in mind, I think, is to use the words of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and say we have no reason to fear the powers of this world because God can deliver us. And even if he doesn't deliver us from this current evil, we will still serve him who controls the destination of our eternity. Jesus makes a comparison in verses 6 and 7, Luke chapter 12, verses 6 and 7. That's right, 6, 7. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Not one of them is forgotten before God. Why, even the hairs in your head are all numbered. Fear not. You are more valuable than many sparrows. In Matthew's version of this, chapter 10, 29, 30, and 31, it says, are not 2 sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs in your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore. You are more valuable than many sparrows. There's a little bit of a discrepancy between those two on the price of sparrows. Did y'all catch it? Luke says 5 sparrows are sold for 2 pennies. Matthew says 2 sparrows are sold for a penny. It's a bargain deal, right? You can get 5 for 2 pennies or 2 for 1 penny. In the context of this, a cent is about 1/16 of a day's pay. So if you worked 8 hours in easy math, because I need easy math, if you worked 8 hours and you made $10 an hour, it's about $5 to buy 2 sparrows for 2 birds. The difference between those numbers in Matthew and in Luke is really inconsequential to what this is painting, the picture this is painting for us. It's an inconsequential amount to buy a handful of these birds. If you spend 30 minutes or an hour of your wage to buy a handful of these birds, they don't amount to a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. If they live, that's fine. If you eat them, that's fine. If they fly off, it's fine. Sparrows being the least of all birds for them. And yet, the least of those is a concern to God. Not one of them, it says, is forgotten before God. Every single one of them matters. Every single detail of everything is known by God. All of time, all of events. He says, even the hairs on your head are numbered. All of us, all of the hairs. On the average human head, there's 100,000 hairs. Interestingly, redheads have more hairs than other people. Who knew? Yeah. There you go. On average, 100,000 hairs on every one of our heads, and on average, we lose 75 of those a day that start getting replaced by new hairs starting to grow. Have you lost 75 yet today? On average. 6 or 7, yeah. Fact is, we don't know how many hairs each one of us has on our heads. We don't count them. We probably couldn't count them. If you tried, you would probably go mad. But God knows. Even the hairs in your head are all numbered. If he cares about the sparrows and he cares about the number of hairs on our heads, how much more is he concerned with the movements of our lives here and our eternal destiny forever? Those are big deals. He says, "Fear not. You are of more value than many sparrows." Nothing escapes God. Nothing in our lives escapes him. Our concerns, our worries, our pleasures, nothing escapes him. All of our actions are known to God, and all the causes for those actions are known to God, who sees all and accounts for all. MacArthur's commentary on this, he said, "But while the truth is comfort to believers, it should be a cause of terror to hypocrites, whose fraudulent self-righteousness will avail them nothing in light of God's complete and detailed knowledge of their true unregenerate condition." I think that statement's a little bit rattling. When we wear the mask, when we put on the happy face, because we've got to have the image, we've got to hide behind what we think other people need to see in us. We use words that sound good, but they're empty inside. If we act or think in sinful ways, God knows all of that. He sees through all of that. And kind of like we talked about last week, in the same light, he sees the good parts too. He sees and hears our prayers. Most other people probably don't. He knows the good things that we do for other people that may never get recognition at all. The things that we do that we don't seek glory for, anything from anyone, no reward, no compensation. God knows of those things too. And that's why the common question boils down to why. Why do we live the way that we live? Why do we drive what we drive? Why do we say what we say and wear what we wear? Why do we want what we want? Is it for the glory of God or for the attention of people? Are we more concerned with the eternal God who determines our eternal destiny, or with what some person that we don't really like thinks about us for this 1 minute? The world has very little power over our lives and no power over our eternities. So my closing to this is to fear the Lord, to fear the King of Kings, the Creator of heaven and earth, the Sustainer of all life, who knows you more deeply than you know yourself, who loves you more completely than anyone in this world ever will, and who's more concerned with your well-being now and later than anyone else ever can be. So that's what I got. Let's talk about it. Questions, comments, corrections?